Welcome back to Sex Talks Podcast with me, your host, Salman Dasilohenda Iyambo. As always, I'm super excited to be here with you, and I'm beyond grateful that you chose Sex Talks Podcast once again. If you are a first-time listener, welcome to the Sex Talks Podcast family. Here, we are all about creating an informed and educated society of young people who can openly have conversations on sexual health matters while sharing their personal experiences and hearing from experts in the field. We are recording yet another episode live from the Be Free Youth Campus in Katutura thanks to our collaboration with the Be Free Studios under the One Economy Foundation. You can find this youth-friendly space at the Multipurpose Youth Center or online at Be Free Namibia. Today, I'm joined by an extraordinary guest who's here to share their story, a story of resilience, hope, and empowerment. We will dive into the triumphs, the challenges, and the lessons they've learned while living with HIV. This episode is in commemoration of World AIDS Day, and we are going to shed light on what it means to live boldly and thrive with HIV. Our guest today is Tuilika Elias, who is a public policy analyst, HIV and gender-based violence advocate, as well as a Fulbright alumni with a master's in public affairs from the University of Missouri in Colombia. She is a survivor of sexual violence and a young woman who's living with HIV. Tuilika brings a deeply personal perspective to her advocacy. She champions for youth-led conversations on HIV and gender-based violence, focusing on the intersection of education, poverty, and inequality. With her experience in local government, community development, and project management, Tuilika has contributed to policy initiatives in addressing homelessness, urban sustainability, and poverty. She also serves on boards such as Oyayone Foundation and Regain Trust, driving programs that empower vulnerable women and combat systemic inequality. She is passionate about addressing poverty and inequality, and she's currently building a career in international development while promoting sustainable solutions. Outside of work, she enjoys traveling, reading, nurturing plants, and exploring the world through coffee. Wow. Just before we even continue, I think I already love Tuilika because of the fact that she explores the world through coffee. Tuilika, welcome to Sex Talks Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us for this special episode. How are you doing?
So much. Thank you for having me, and I'm excited to be here. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm amazing. I'm in your company, so what else? To start off our conversation, I've shared quite a very lengthy biography. Tuilika, can you maybe just tell us a bit about yourself? Who are you? What do you love doing? Like, on days when you're not just busy working on sustainability, what do you do?
So a little bit of background about myself is that I'm from Valdez. Mm-hmm. And so the funny thing is that I don't know how to spell Warwick. I struggle saying Valdez in English. I struggle saying Warwick Bay. So I always just stick to Valdez. I struggle with the English version of Valdez Bay, you know, so I would rather say the African version.
Which is?
Valdez Bay. And English is Walvis Bay, right? So I struggle with that. Mm-hmm. So I'm from Valdez, and I was raised in a single-headed household that composed of my mother. I have 5 siblings. Mm-hmm. And I am a twin.
Wait, what?
Yes, you're very lucky that you get to know that I'm a twin in the short period of knowing me and meeting me. So I have a twin. And
identical?
No, not identical at all. Not identical. So I have a twin, and I have a twin. In my spare time, like the introduction said, I love traveling so much. I feel like the world is so huge and there's so much for us to explore. And there's so much beauty to see and to experience, meeting new people, meeting, eating food from all walks of life in different spaces. I think one of my most exciting activities to do while traveling is navigating myself through new spaces and towns and having to use your Google map to try and find where you're supposed to be going. And like you said, I love coffee. And
where is this love coming from?
I don't know. I've always loved coffee, but then it's until I went to the US that, you know, got exposed to the coffee shops. And I'm like, this is such a space I like being in. The fact that I love coffee, and then you also have books and you have plants, you have all of that in one space. It's heaven.
Wow. Like,
yes. Yeah.
Can you open up a coffee shop? Like, I'll be your number one customer and we could be besties. And then I get to meet you.
Can I apply for funding?
That's a conversation for after this episode. But yeah. I'm so shocked that you have a twin. Is it a twin brother?
A sister. It's a twin sister.
Guys, maybe I should have a podcast for twins.
Selma.
Yeah, wait, Willika, thank you so much for that. Mm-hmm. It's quite interesting to hear that you have a twin, but the conversation for today is one that is a commemoration for World AIDS mm-hmm. Day. Now, can you please tell us about your journey of being diagnosed with HIV?
Where do I start?
From the beginning. Like, I have all the time in the world for you.
From the beginning, it's a lengthy story, but to make it short, mm-hmm. I found out I was HIV positive when I was in grade 11. I was still in school. And, you know, it's one thing to know and to be educated about HIV, but it's another when it hits home and when it's yourself, right, being told that you're HIV positive. So what happened is that I remember my grade 10, I wrote my exams very sick, my last final exam, because by then the school system, we were still on the old school system, right? And I wrote my exams sick. Anyways, I passed, went on to grade 11.
Mm-hmm. And this was in Valvers?
This was in Valvers. Went on to grade 11, but I remember I went for the holidays. Before I went for the holidays, I was sick, right? And then an uncle of mine who had health insurance and, you know, used to use Velvicha, the private hospital, takes me to Velvicha, right? And I get medications and I get well for that holiday time. But come January, I got sick again. And this time around, I took myself to the clinic. So I'm a very independent person and I went to a boarding school. So things such as taking myself to the clinic, it was never a thing of, oh, let me tell my mother I'm sick so that she can. No, I take myself to the clinic. So I took myself to the clinic and went into the nurse room. And then she asked me questions and she's like, oh, when was the last, have you ever done an HIV test? I'm like, no, I've never even thought about it. And then she's like, oh, come back next week, Tuesday. I think they used to do the test on Tuesdays only, or Tuesday and another day. But she said, come back next week, Tuesday. And I get back on Tuesday, and it was in the morning. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you go to the clinic wearing your school uniform, you get
Special treatment.
You don't have to study there. So I knew about that. Mm-hmm. So I go, and I go into the nurse room. And you know how they do this prep talk before doing the test, the counseling. And she asked me, you know, one of the questions that they always ask was like, so what are you going to do? Like, if the results come back positive or negative? Mm-hmm. Listen, when she asked me that question, mm-hmm. one thing about me, I'll cry you a river, right? I already started crying, right? And she's like, why are you crying? Like, crying, you know. She does the test and just leave it there on the table and walks out of the room. Mm-hmm. By then I was already crying and she had already seen what the results are. And because I was crying, she didn't know how to tell me, how to break it to me. So she went out of the room, I guess to prepare herself on how she's going to address it and how she's going to tell me. And she comes back into the room and then she says, why are you crying? Did you look at the test results? I'm like, no, I didn't, right? Mm-hmm. And then she tells me that I'm HIV positive. So,
how old were you?
I was grade 11.
So that's 17.
At the time, yes. Yeah. So she tells me, and yeah, I could see my grave. The first thing that came to mind is me dying, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's because in the media, that's all what's portrayed. And I think by then, I didn't even know the difference between HIV and AIDS, right? Because then there's a difference. I thought I was going to die, and I thought I was going to die so young because I was only grade 11. I still have my whole life ahead of me. And now you are telling me that I'm HIV positive. And she keeps saying that it's going to be okay. And I'm like, nothing is going to be okay, right? And I'm an academic, right? I love school. And I'm like, so you are telling me that I have HIV, meaning I'm going to die? And I always wanted to become a gynecologist. I always wanted to go into the health field. And my goal was always to go to school of medicine and study to become a gynecologist. And I'm like, that is so gone. It's down the drain, you know. She says it's going to be okay. Put me through the whole counseling. And I go for that period of time when I was in the office. And I go home, right? The reality about being HIV positive kicked in, and about how society will see me, right? How people will look at me and think about me. And it played a huge part in how I coped going forward. Because then now I was worried about, what do I tell people? Listen, I didn't want to get thin. I didn't want to lose weight. Mm-hmm. I was like, before we reach the point where I lose weight and die, let me take my own life. You know, that's how scared I was. And I remember one of the pictures that was always in my mind, and I always said that before I reach that point, you see how they have this, whenever they have videos of HIV and AIDS, it's always like some person in gray color and their cheekbones are out. You could see the eyes, you could see the ribs, the shoulders. And I'm like, there's no way I'm going to get to that point before we even get there. Listen, I'm going to chip out of this life. So that was me. And I was grade 11, right? So
was that, you said that was a school day, so you just went straight home and didn't go to school anymore?
Oh, no, I skipped that part. So because I love school, school is my safe space. She told me that I'm HIV positive. I went back to school.
And you just went on like everything was okay?
I just went on, and I still remember to this day, we had a double period geography, right? And I still to this day remember who was sitting opposite me, next to me. And I think because it's a double period and it's a 2-year class, you don't change. I guess I still know who was sitting besides me and everything. I went to school and continued life like I wasn't just told one of the saddest things in my life.
So the show just continued?
The show just continued. I went to school. I went home. And because I was a student, right, I was still a minor. And I was crying uncontrollably. Then the nurse asked for my mother's number.
That's the part I was going to get to. That's why I asked you how old you were, because I was like, how?
So she called my mother, and I said, it's okay, I'm going to go to school. And then after school, that's when I'm going to go home, and we will have to come back. Remember I said I have a twin sister? Mm-hmm. And then they said, we will do the test and go home, go to school. We called your mother, you guys are going to come back, right? Because now everybody doesn't, they don't know where I got the HIV from, right? Then I go to school, she didn't say anything to my sister. My sister used to sit opposite me in the class. Didn't say anything to her, but we're also not living in the same household. So I tell her that actually we need to go to the clinic. I didn't explain. Mm-mm. You and your mother, all of us, we need to go to the clinic. And then we go, and then we kind of just redid the test and pretend like it was the first time we were both being tested. And mine came back positive, of course. And then, yeah, that's how the news was broke out to them, and life went on.
You know, I'm looking at you because the way you're like, life just went on.
Life went on because I think life went on for everybody else, mm-hmm. but not for me. because then that's where depression came in. So when I tested, my CD4 count was still good, mm-hmm. right? Because then if you reach, I think, less than 350 or below that, then you have to go on treatment, mm-hmm. right? And they said by then the World Health Organization had already given out the rule that whenever you test HIV positive, you go on medication immediately. And I refused. I refused to go on medication because I was just not ready to start medication. And I think my fear was the fact that you have to take medications every day at the same time, and I was not up for that. I don't like taking medication. Now you have to. I feel like it was a force because I'm not doing it because I want to, but I'm doing it because I don't have a choice and I need to keep me alive, right? But then I remember we had a grade 12 tour to Etosha, and there was no way I was going to go to an educational tour with ARVs in my bag that I need to take. I was, hell no, we are not taking it. And I think they were good enough and allowed me not to start medication because I was still doing well. But then, like I say, depression kicked in and everything just went downhill.
So at what point did you now take the medication?
When depression kicked in, I think everything just preoccupied my mind. And then I started losing weight. My CD4 count started dropping, right? And then when it dropped, they were like, listen, your CD4 count is going down, you're losing weight.
And you're going to be like those cartoons that you used to see.
You need to take medication. You need to start taking medication. And that's when I started taking the medications in grade 12.
And how did this affect the relationship with your friends? Did you not disclose it to them, or you just...
There was no disclose, no nothing. For most part, I did my HIV journey alone. I didn't share with people. I kept it to myself. I took myself to my doctor's appointment. I took myself to collect my medication. I just did it by myself.
Now let's talk about your depression now, how it started kicking in. Were you able to seek now psychosocial support? Did you have medical aid, or how did that go for you?
At that time, what is psychosocial support?
So what was happening now? How were you coping?
Just living through it. Just living through it, to be honest, Alma. I don't know how I was coping, but I hide a lot behind my books. I spend a lot of time at school. I love reading. So I do activities that enables me not to think about it, right? And I think I was also I was in denial. I didn't accept it. So I kind of push it at the back of my head and didn't think about it as it's there on my, I don't even want to say it's at the back of my, it's very complicated. It's there, but not there.
Wait, which year was this? Because then when you asked, what was psychosocial at that time?
2013, 2014. But also remember that, you know, you come from households where we don't talk about such things. And also, even after my diagnosis, there was never a word of conversation in my household about how I'm doing.
Yeah, I was about to ask now, seeing that you hid this journey from your friends, was your twin sister in the picture, your younger siblings, and your mom?
Mother, nothing. Like I said, I did it by myself. There was no conversation about... I remember when I came back from the clinic, and then my mother goes like, so... how did you get HIV? And I didn't say how I got it, right? And then she just asked, oh, did you sleep with somebody in my house? And I'm like, I didn't. And I'm already HIV positive. There's nothing we can do. But that was the first time and the last time we ever had a conversation up to today. It's been 10 years. And it's non-existent in my household.
I know this may sound a bit triggering, and the fact that she asked you on the spot as a grade 11 child. But like, at that point when she asked how you contracted it, was it ever a thought of maybe this, maybe that, or you were just like, I'm going to put it at the back of my head as well?
Me? From my side?
Yeah, when she asked.
I was going to put it at the back of my head. That's why my response was like, it's already done. I'm HIV positive. There's nothing we can do. There's no reverse. So we move.
You are a very brave young woman. I don't know what I was going to do, because like the thought of it and processing as to what could possibly happen. And, you know, there's a friend of mine from South Africa who's a TikToker, and she's also living with HIV. And she flagged it like, don't ask me how I got HIV. Like, why do you want to know? So I can already imagine what you can then be going through as an individual when they ask you.
As an individual, it can be a lot, hey? It can be a lot. And I think this was one of the answers I was going to go give in one of the questions I had. But it's I think part of the questions you had asked, or part of the questions is, how should you engage with me? And part of it is...
Wait, save that one for later. It's going to get into the story, but yeah. Wait.
Okay.
So we'll get to that part. But then it was more of, now you asked, it's already done, nothing can happen. So let's just move on.
Yeah, let's just move on. And I'm grade 11, grade 12. I'm supposed to go to university. I want to become a doctor. I need to study. I need to have 35 points and about to go to UNAM School of Medicine. So my focus was, I need to pass. I need to pass, and I need to move out of Valves. And I can only move out of Valves if I pass.
So I was going to ask, how did this affect your grades? And did you manage to go to School of Medicine?
No, I didn't. I didn't manage to go to School of Medicine because I didn't get enough points to go to School of Medicine.
So what did you end up pursuing? So this was like now the depression.
My first choice was medicine, right? And my second choice was nursing. I had a list of careers that I wanted to be or wanted to study. And part of that list, clinical psychology was also one of them. So when my application came from UNAM, School of Medicine, nursing was already full. I'm like, oh, okay, late registration, clinical psychology is open, it's on my list, we're going to go for clinical psychology. But part of it also is me being comfortable with going for clinical psychology, because I had questions, and I thought that clinical psychology would also give me those answers that I'm looking for. So yeah, I ended up doing clinical psychology for my undergrad. I wasn't so happy in the first maybe 6 months, and I ended up applying for nursing again that same year. But by the end of the year, I already fell in love with a clinical psychology, and so much that when the acceptance for nursing came, I'm like, nah, it's okay. I'm fine here.
I'm happy here. Please take it. Somebody else would appreciate the opportunity to go into nursing.
So yeah, that's how I coped.
The story is quite inspiring too, like I must say. Now, I think throughout the story, you've mentioned that school was your safest place. I think, and you've also now seen that you hide a lot behind your books. Was there like things happening at home? And you also then have mentioned that you are a survivor of sexual violence. Was that now prior to the diagnosis, or was it after?
Prior to the diagnosis.
If there's one thing we'd like to highlight today, is that there is life beyond HIV. Mm-hmm. Can you share some of your personal trials and the things that you achieved despite your diagnosis?
I think the biggest of them all is still being alive, right?
You know, as soon as I asked, like, does that mean of survival?
Yes, still being alive. I had a conversation with somebody, and they just reminded me of how, despite everything, the rape, because now that I'm not only dealing with HIV alone, then there's also the rape, right? And both of them come with so much weight, so much shame, so much stigma and discrimination. And especially when you look at it from the perspective how, you know, to be HIV positive, you must have done something wrong, right? How, you know, when you do an HIV test, it's just not just an HIV test. It's also a test of your morality. You must have been a naughty person for you to get infected with HIV. And people always, or a lot of time, there's that misconception that you only get HIV through unprotected sex. And it's not the same for everybody. You know, some people get it through rape. Some people are born with it, you know, needle sharing and all of that. So having to live with coming to terms being HIV positive, and also having my trauma from the rape, and still being alive and you know, got through not committing suicide and everything, I think for me that's an achievement itself.
It's an achievement, like
Yes.
And
why I say it's a big achievement is because for a long time I thought I was gonna die, right? I was so scared of dying, and I thought I was gonna die that at some point I had to learn living while thinking that I was dying, right? And it comes from somebody when I was grade 10, this man was giving us tutoring, grade 10 mathematics tutoring, and he was planning on going to do his master's in SA. And one of the students asked, but you're already having a good job. Why do you want to go do a master's in SA? What if you die tomorrow? And he said, then I die while doing what I love. And I think that stuck with me for some time. And then eventually when I got into the, you know, space of accepting, not really accepting, but just living through with Asia, I'm like, okay, sharp. Even if I die, let me continue living my life. Then I die having gotten my undergrad degree, you know, and seeing where I will be by the time I die.
You will die in the process of doing something that you love and achieving your goals. Yes. That's quite commendable.
So being alive, finishing my undergrad, after work, you know, working for Be Free at the time, you know, after grade, working for the office of the First Lady, and then, you know, I've always wanted to do my master's, right? And I always thought I was going to do it in Scotland because I love Scotland. But I ended up doing it in the US and getting the Fulbright scholarship. That was definitely an achievement for me because I think society has this definition of if you are HIV positive, then there's limits to what you can be and to what you can achieve. You know, there are certain standards that are set for us that you can only live up to here. And for me, that was an indication that, hey, HIV is just part of who I am, right? It's just a part of my journey. It's not who I am. And I'm just like everybody else. I can still live out my dreams. I had dreams before I found out that I was HIV positive. Why is it that after the diagnosis they are no longer valid or they are no longer dreams that I can achieve, right? So for me, those are some of my biggest achievements.
Well done, Tuweleka. Personally, I'm very, very proud of you.
Thank you.
Now, you've mentioned that at the time there wasn't really, or what was psychosocial support at the time. At what point were you able to get psychosocial support?
What point? So this is the interesting fun or interesting thing. Like I mentioned, I'm school. I love school. And I love history. I love history. And I was at UNAM. And I don't sleep in class. That's not me. I don't sleep in class. How's in any history class? So when I moved to Windhoek, it was still the same thing. Before I mentioned moving to Windhoek. So when I was still in Valves, grade 10, there was this lady we had, you know, the things that they used to do during the August holiday where you have the tutoring, mock exam, where you...
Oh, the mock exam.
Yeah, and you guys, different schools come to one school and... So there was a lady I met at the time who gave a beautiful speech, and I just felt like, and she gave out her number. And when I was still in grade 12, grade 11, I reached out to her and I opened up to her, and she was able to help me cope with everything at the time, right? When I was grade 11, grade 12. But then she ended up moving and I lost contact with her. So when I moved to Windhoek, I was all by myself. And for most part, I was just alone with nobody to help me in terms of psychosocial support. I didn't have that because I lost contact with her, so I was back to square one. So in my second year, depression hits, right? I'm in my history class. I'm just sleeping. And then my professor comes. One day we're sitting outside, and that's Dr. Akawa, by the way. I love her a lot. She comes in and she asks me, what's wrong? Why are you sleeping in the class so much? Are you okay? And I don't want to say I'm good at pretending, but I'm good at masking. I think when you have so much trauma and when you are living your life hiding, you kind of...
You always have a wall that is up and ready to fight.
And you develop two personalities. I have this personality, Tuleka, the personality that I'm presenting to the rest of the world, right? I could be having a bad episode and crying the night before, but in the morning I will show up fully. I will show up like I was not having a crying episode until 2 a.m. That's how good I am at. And I learned at a very young age how to snap in and out of emotions, right? I would be here crying. Listen, I'll wipe my tears, I'll go out there and start laughing. You know, that's how good I became at it. But then when she noticed that I was not okay, that's when I noticed that, I'm not doing it well. I'm not covering it up enough. And that's when I knew it was time to seek for help. I went on Google and then I Googled organizations, right, where I can seek help. I saw what is Catholic Aid Action, I think, and many others, but I ended up going to Regain Trust. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's the organization I reached out to at the time, and they did help me. They did made me go through sessions, which really helped with that depressive episode and starting the idea of me seeking real help or being open to my friends, for some which I ended up opening, I think, to two or three at the time. And I think that's where it started. That's where the psychosocial started. But just for a bit, because I was still close off. It was still a secret. I think it just helped me with coping with that depressive episode at the time, or suicidal episode at the time.
And now you're this young person who's openly living with HIV. How did you transition from the two?
I was tired. To be honest, people ask me, how did you get here? I was just tired. Like I mentioned, I lived a life of hiding, right? And when I say hiding, it's things such as I have to lie to my friends at UNAM why they have to write down my name in the class because, you know, I need to go get my ARVs or I have a doctor's appointment. I had to lie about why I'm dizzy or nauseous at school in the morning, because the ARVs I had at the time used, the side effects for me was nauseousness and just being dizzy. So, and also just I think the impact of having been a broke student, sham. So you have these medications that you are taking that requires you to eat constantly and to eat a good balanced diet, but again at home you have no food. So you go home, you drink this medication, and you have no food. And sometimes we just have rice. Me and my sister will just have rice, and we eat rice, and tomorrow we go to school. Or we just, the other thing that we used to do, we always make sure to buy potatoes, right? Because potatoes are very filling, and you just have the potatoes in the house with water, and you have salt, and you put just salt on the potatoes, and you eat, you drink your pills, and you go to school. But with the level of dizziness, the concentration of the ARVs, sometimes that didn't used to work. So I end up going to school feeling dizzy, not okay, and not being able to explain to my friends why I'm not okay, what's going on. And I don't know. It's that whole tiredness. Even when I joined the Be Free, you know, January to December, Monday to Friday, it's you walking around issues of sexual violence, gender-based violence, sexual violence, HIV, teenage pregnancy. And these are some of the social issues that I'm experiencing in my own life, but nobody knows. So when I engage in a conversation, it ended up being where I can't say anything that will make something click that it relates to me. So I always had to speak from a theoretical point of view, you know. It's just a lot of the hiding and the running from myself and the world that I got tired of, but was also very scared to come out.
Which year did you join the Be Free movement?
In 2019.
In 2019.
Yes.
And now, speaking about how scary it was to come out, what was the worst expectation that you had in mind of what the world was going to say and do to you?
A judgment. I was afraid of the judgment. I was afraid of the rejection. I was afraid of the whole view of how people are going to look at me. What did she do? I think the acceptance part was the most difficult for me. And I for most part, I spend so much time worried about what people would think.
What? How? If I may ask, and this mm-hmm. might also be triggering, mm-hmm. how did you open up about living with HIV?
When I came out?
Yeah. How was that? Are you able to describe the process wise?
So, you know, it's actually funny that we are doing this during the 16 days of activism. So what happened is that I was done, and I was just done running. I was done running, and I reached a point where I didn't care anymore. Who knows how they're going to treat me? And I think what made me reach that point is I didn't mention that there is an angle of mine that helped my mother raise us, right? So, and I thought that I owe my uncle. I thought that I owe him excellence. I thought that I owe him to do good in life, to achieve things in life. So, and I always thought that he should know, right, mm-hmm. about my status and everything, but I wasn't bold enough. So I lived life trying to perform so that when I tell him...
You at least achieved something.
I at least achieved something. It would not be a case of, I spent so much money on you and this is what you're bringing me, right? So I passed my fourth year, I graduate, I'm like, okay, at least I have an honors degree. If I tell him, it's not so bad, right? Mm-hmm. Eventually, that wasn't good. In my eye, it wasn't good enough. And then I got into the office of the, by then, One Economy Foundation, under the office of the first day, I'm like, I got into the office. This is something big.
You know,
it's one of the highest offices in the country. And then after a short time, it wasn't good. I didn't feel it was good enough.
So you kept the running again.
I kept the running. And I'm like, let me apply for a master's degree abroad. At least it would be nice. When I didn't get the Chevening scholarship, but then I got accepted into Manchester University. And that's when I realized that Nothing is ever going to make me feel that I'm good enough. Mm-hmm. Nothing is ever going to make me feel that I'm worth somebody helping me. And that's when I dropped everything. That's when I dropped everything. And during the 16 days of activism that year, Break Free was supposed to have where survivors of sexual violence share their stories anonymously, or, you know, you go and you write a letter. So they had to write letters to their rapist. I remember writing that letter, but it was going to be submitted anonymously. And I write the letter and I submit to Lely, right? Mm-hmm. But then Lely had known, because we had this group, I think Lely, me and Esther and somebody else, we had this group where we encourage each other to write. And that's how I wrote that article, and I just dropped it on the WhatsApp group. How they respond to it,
that's up to them.
It's up to them. They were very sweet. So I write that letter and I submit it to Lely, and that was 2020 now. Mm-hmm. I submitted to Lely for the event, but I was going to be anonymous. I chickened out. I think 2 weeks before the event, I chickened out. I'm like, Lely, can you please give me back my letter? And you know how Lely is sweet, and Lely goes like, yeah, to Elika, it's okay. You don't have to do it if you're not ready. I took it back, and then fast forward, it's 2021. Mm-hmm. I then moved to the U.S. And I was just like, I'm gone.
What can they do to me?
What can they do to me? I had control over who had access to me. Would only reach me on my social media platform. I could switch out, off, and delete the platforms. WhatsApp, I could, you know, delete my WhatsApp. You can't reach me via phone call or text message. So that gave me a little bit of confidence, right? And yeah, that's how I disclosed. I was tired. And part of it was also, I always longed to have somebody to look up to that was driven as I am, or that sought after the things I wanted out of this world, mm-hmm. right? And I didn't have that. So I was like, why don't I be that for myself? Why do I have to keep running? And I'm already just exhausted. And the exhaustion also came from the aspect that it held me back in so many ways. I'll be in rooms. Rather than speaking up, I'm so scared. I cannot.
Because we are scared of what will they say again.
Yes. I was just tired of all of that. And yeah, that's how the disclosure happened.
I admire your bravery too, Lika. Just for clarity, Break Free is one of the pillars under the One Economy Foundation. Should you require any psychosocial support, we are available at the Be Free Youth Campus, that is at the Multipurpose Youth Center in Bothell Street. Or alternatively, you can reach out to us on our various social media platforms, that's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram at Be Free Namibia, or at Break Free itself. so we can be able to provide you with the necessary assistance. Or you can just walk in. The campus is open from Monday to Friday from 8 o'clock to 1700 hours. And you can sign up to be a member. Just check the link in our bio on our various social media platforms. Now, you've opened up about how you've then been living in fear, running, and then just, you know, getting tired and speaking out. What are some of the things that you wish people understood about people living with HIV?
That HIV does not have a face. And I'm starting with this one because the danger in thinking that HIV has a face is that people think that to be HIV positive, you need to look a specific way. So that leads to people going around and saying, because if you meet me, you would never think I'm HIV positive, right? So it leads to people being a little bit careless and not protecting themselves when, you know, having sex with somebody, because you think that, oh, this person doesn't look like somebody who's HIV positive.
So you're going to have
unprotected sex. Yeah, because you don't think I have HIV. And also, I don't know if people think it's a good compliment and I'm supposed to say thank you. But no.
Wait, which one?
You know, when somebody says you don't look like you have HIV, I don't know if people think that's a good compliment. Because, you know, sometimes people say it so nicely, right? And I think sometimes it comes from even just when you're having conversation and you have known this person, and they say, but you don't look like you have HIV, you know?
How is
an
HIV positive?
Yes, and sometimes I feel like they think it's a good thing, like to say that, you don't, and I'm supposed to say thank you, but no, it's not. So HIV does not have a face. The other thing is that I am not my HIV. HIV is just a part of my journey. And I say that because of there's a whole lot of systemic inequality that is often said, and you are expected, I guess, to navigate your way through that by yourself without any support or anything. And I mentioned this because when I got my scholarship, right, I applied for the scholarship. I got a scholarship and it was time to move to the US. And you have to do medical tests, right, before you leave. And I submit the form, and that's when they found out I was HIV positive. And they go ahead and ask and say to me, by the way, we fund everybody else. We give health insurance, but we don't give health insurance for HIV and anything in that regard. Are you still going to take the scholarship? So that was a blow in the face. I think for me, that's, you know, I already have my issues I'm dealing with, right? And I've always been passionate about school and wanting to apply. And here I get this great opportunity, but now you are telling me that I can't get this scholarship simply because of my HIV status. And you look at it from, when you look at it from a deeper level and you say, but hey, these are the same people that tells me that there's nothing wrong with being HIV positive. You can dream, you can live out your potential, you can be who you are. Yet here you are telling me that actually you are good in all aspects, but just not good to invest
because you are HIV positive.
And I didn't say, no, I'm going to take the scholarship. And then they say, if you're going to take the scholarship, you have to provide proof that you'll be able to access health care in the US. And yeah, because I dream and I believe in so much, my plan was to ship ARVs from Namibia every 4 months. That was my plan.
How did that work out?
My plan was to ship ARVs from Namibia every 4 months. And I think what made it even so possible. So that was plan number one. Mm-hmm. Plan number two, I knew Flon comes to the US every September, UN General Assembly. Mm-hmm. I was like, if my plan is not going to work out, I have Flon that's coming to the US every September. So that was plan number B. I get to the US and I meet the system that's very divergent in the sense that it's not ours where, it's not the same as ours where I go to the hospital and get all my services there. You need to have health insurance. First of all, what is health insurance? Mina, I am a public child. I don't know what health insurance. If I'm sick, I get out of my house, go to the clinic,
like,
or go.
Everything was just there. Like, you can get all the services. What do you mean?
What do you mean? I need to have health insurance, right? I get to the US and it was so stressful. I'm in a foreign country, and I'm grateful that I didn't know about the US health system. Before I left, because had I known, I would have said no to the scholarship, right? So throw myself into the ditch, and I navigated my way, but it was difficult. It took a, you know, I mentioned about getting depressed, being suicidal, but it had never crippled me. I could still be depressed and walk out and give you a 10 out of 10. For the first time in my life, I asked for an extension on a deadline, because I was just depressed. When I moved to the US, I first moved to Springfield, that's one city. After 5 months, I had to move to another city where I was doing my master's, right? And when I moved from one city to another, this city did not allow me to move with the health insurance, so I had to start over from scratch. That means that look Google and trying to find health insurance company that would give me, and that was a lot, that was stressful with no help from anybody, right? So that was a lot on me, took a toll on me. And that's what leads me to get into this depressive episode so much that it paralyzes me, and I had to ask for this extension on a deadline, something that has never happened in my life before. Depression had never crippled me like that before. So that was, it wasn't nice. It wasn't nice, and I navigated. I managed to find health insurance and got my ARVs, but I would say it put me on educational probation. That's how bad it was. And what I mean by educational probation is, with Fulbright, we are required to achieve a 3.0 GPA, right? GPA, yeah, I had to get a 3.0, average 3.0 GPA, right? And I got a 2.9. That was a problem, and they put me on probation, and yeah, but it was
so that's what it means, put me on an education probation,
mate. Oh, it means, ne, that you need to achieve a 3.0. If you don't achieve a 3.0 GPA, maybe in your second semester, then they will have to take you out of the program. Yes. But then the good thing about them is they try to understand what's wrong, what's going on, where are you lacking, how can we help you, go to the student center, go seek counseling. And that's what I did. But also getting a health insurance helped me a lot, because now I was no longer worried about
shipping,
and I was also
I was about to ask you, so how did the shipping go for the first 2 months?
No, it never happened. It never happened, because my initial taking, I met this doctor who was so nice, who referenced to me to a sister of hers who was working at the health at the hospital, who knew somebody who was working with an NGO.
You knew someone, and
you navigate, you go from this hospital to this hospital to this institution, because that's how, you know, different it is. Yeah.
Your story is inspiring. I don't know how many times I'm going to keep saying this, but wow, man.
There was a point where I looked at myself, and when that probation, academic probation came, like, I'm like, I left free ARVs in Namibia. Yeah.
Just for this. Well, it all paid off in the end. Here we are.
Yes,
and you survived.
Yes.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. Now, you've mentioned how you've been navigating it and how you disclosed this to your friend. If any of us have a friend, a relative, or somebody that we know that is living with HIV, and even if we don't, HIV does not have a face, because we might run into or have one of them.
Mm-hmm.
What type of conversations should we be able to have? How do we be supportive towards them? How do we create an environment where they don't have to continuously run. They don't continuously have to be in a cage, but they can be able to open up and actually seek support from us.
So I would say that's a tricky question because of my take on that question, right? But I would say number one, create a supportive environment. Create an environment where I don't have to be scared about me being HIV positive when I'm in your presence, right? That's very, very important. And I say this because sometimes you find people that says, but I'm closest to her. Why did she never disclose to me? But where you're a safe space. And I had a friend who once made a comment, and that was the day I knew that I was never going to disclose to them because of the comment they made.
What was the comment? Are you able to remember it, maybe?
I think the comment was around somebody at their house also being HIV positive, and she complained about, I think she complained about what she did. It's not such a huge thing, but for me, that made me feel scared, right? And I also say that we must be careful of what we say when in the presence of other people, or just in general, right? Because you don't know what other people are going through. And what you say can deter that person from you or seeking help from you. So creating a very supportive, safe space. And I always say that you don't have to like me. You don't have to help me in any way. You don't have to be in support of me being HIV positive. But also, in all of while doing that, or while you're that person, make sure that the environment around you is not a space where you're making it difficult for me to be my authentic self. It's okay. For me, that's what I say. Create a safe space for me to be my authentic self, where I don't feel like I have to beg to feel loved. I have to beg to being tolerated living with HIV, right? My other take is that as somebody who's living with HIV, somebody, there's just so much you can do for me. If I don't open up to you, there's no way you're going to know that I'm going through this and I need your help, right? And I say this because I think sometimes we expect people to be there for us while not letting them in, right? And I don't blame, especially my undergrad friends, I don't blame them for not having been there for me in the way that they are now, because they didn't know. And there were a lot of them that knew me especially, and that picked up behaviors and will ask, but I would not be honest with them. So how do I expect them to get the help that I need? Disclosure is very difficult, something difficult to do. But even if it's just finding one person that you can open up to and communicate your feeling, communicate how you feel, but most importantly as well, communicate how you want them to treat you. Somehow I can come to you right now and I can open up. And I think me communicating how you want me to help, how I want you to help me, is very important. And that goes by saying, hey, Selma, I'm going through this. I just want you to listen. That's all I need from you right now. Or, Selma, I'm going through this. I want you to listen, but then I also want you to go with me to the clinic. Or I want you, tomorrow I'm not able to. Can you please go to the hospital and pick up my ARVs for me? You know, or can you take a walk with me because I'm feeling down? Communicate how you want to be treated, the help that you need, because that enables people to give you the best of service that you need and support as well.
That is well said. I think this leads me to my next question. For a young person who's living with HIV right now, who's hopeless, who's lonely and overwhelmed because of the cage they've placed themselves in, the cage they've placed themselves in, or the one that society has placed them in, what would you say to them today?
Oh, and I'm saying this because I lived through it. And I think I'm able to say this with smiling and everything, that it's going to be okay. It's really going to be okay. But you need to start with yourself, accepting your status, taking care of yourself. And when you accept yourself, when you accept your status, it becomes easier to embrace the process, to live through the ups and downs, right? And once you accept yourself, people's opinion really don't matter anymore because you don't care, right? Once you reach that point, it becomes easier to navigate the ups and downs of living with HIV and even just seeking help. It also goes back to communicate, seek out help. I think we are living in a society now where services are more available than back in the day, and there are also now more conversations and platforms where you can reach out for help. Go out and seek out those places, go services. You owe it to yourself. To be honest, you owe it to yourself to take care of yourself. Because it's very scary. Silence is a scary thing. And it ruins you as an individual. It limits you to what you can be and what you can do. But if you go out and seek help, you get the help that you need, and you'll be able to live a life that you're proud of, that you are happy of.
Do not suffer in silence. Yes. So please do make sure to speak, communicate, and it's definitely going to be okay.
Yes.
But it's going to be better if you do speak out. Now, I think that has brought us to the end, but not the final part of this podcast, because we have now integrated a segment that allows us to ask three fun questions to our guests, because the atmosphere is quite tense in here, because I'm holding back my tears. They are somewhere close, because what a story. Now, the fun part, your first question would be, what's the one thing you wish more people knew about HIV? And can you explain it in two sentences? One thing you wish more people knew about HIV that you haven't mentioned in this whole episode.
When you talk about inclusivity, when you talk about equality, when you talk about ending HIV, you cannot talk about that without addressing issues such as poverty, systemic inequality, gender-based violence, stigma, and discrimination, because those are the drivers of HIV in our current world.
Well said. I'm just not sure if it's two sentences. Here is your second question. What's your go-to song that keeps you motivated and feeling strong?
You know, it depends. It depends what I'm going through. I love Brenda Fassie. I love Lucky Dube. I love Passenger. Listen, when I was homesick, do you know who I listened to? Tatekwela.
It helps, man. Being in a foreign country is something you would never explain, because you're like, it's not the same when you're home.
Yes. I love Zahara a lot, a lot, a lot. So it depends what I'm going through. I love, what is this? I love, she's a gospel singer. Stephanie, great singer. I love her a lot. I listen to a lot of Hill songs. I love, what is this? Mafiki Zolo's. So I love a lot of South African music.
You know, I'm just here looking at her. I'm like, I said one, and she said, hold on, I'm gonna give you more.
Diverse, man. I love jazz music. I love country music. So it really depends what I'm going through.
I think I'm gonna phrase it as, you love music.
I love, yeah.
That's the only way we are gonna wrap this one up. Mm-hmm. Now your final question: if you could give yourself a superhero name based on your journey, what would it be, and why?
Actually, I still want to give my name to Willika.
Willika is a superhero.
Yes.
I was about to ask you why, but there's a reason why my tears are this close. Willika, I think before I can let you go, I just remembered we are currently in 16 days of activism. World AIDS Day is on Sunday. And just for context, this episode, just like the many others, is pre-recorded. What message would you have to those that are enduring violence, or those that have endured violence that are currently on their healing journey?
Seek help. I think there's so much power in talking. There's so much power in sharing. And as much as I say that, be careful as well to whom you share. If you're comfortable with the person, do it. If you're not comfortable, don't do it. Take time. I forgot to mention that one of the best advice Flon ever gave me was, take your time. You don't owe anybody an explanation at all, right? So as much as I say seek help, also be patient with yourself. And you don't owe anybody an explanation. Take your time in healing. Don't force yourself. And it's going to be okay. Yes. I guess don't just suffer in silence.
Don't suffer in silence, but that doesn't mean you should just rush and speak out. Be patient with yourself. And at the end of the day, it's going to be okay. With that being said, this has been a meaningful conversation. Thank you for sharing your journey, your wisdom, your light, and being gracious with your time today.
Thank you for hosting me.
To all our listeners, please remember that HIV does not define a person. Together we can break the stigma and support each other in order to live healthy and fulfilling lives. We would love to hear from you as well, so please do make sure to listen, to engage with our artists on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or you can listen on our website, Spotify, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast. So please do stay tuned. Remember, we are still on Season 2, Episode 8 of Your Body, Your Future. That being said, it's been amazing being in your company. Until next time, amigos, adios.